It is, well, thank you. It's great to be here. I'm coming from this week-long thing in Canada, and when we left Saskatoon yesterday, it was literally 3 degrees. So I gained 60 degrees in one day, and my sinuses are making me pay for it. We had 3 flights yesterday. We went from Saskatoon to Calgary, Calgary to San Francisco here. We missed one connection, so I'm afraid if I blow my nose, I'll lose half my brain. So I'm waiting until I'm done here. Sorry to gross you out. But I am thrilled to be here, particularly with this group. I do want to say that tonight I had a couple decisions to make. Some of you might have been planning to come tonight, and I have a whole different session on Cherish I could give. But I really wanted, because I know many of you can't make it, for you to understand the bulk of the Cherish message. So I'm going to be sharing a lot today that I will share tonight. I'll have more time tonight, but it'll be basically taken for what I'm doing tonight. And especially talking to pastors, I'm so pleased to do that, because there's been a couple of events that have really hit me about how having a certain kind of marriage is a ministry in itself. I remember one time when I preach at Houston, if I'm doing the 9:30 service at Woodway, you leave as soon as you're done, as they're wrapping up the service, and they drive me out to the West Campus. And so I come in after the West Campus has already started, and they're in the middle of worship. And we used to live out there. My wife would meet me at that service. And so I did that one time, and I walk in, and I just greeted Lisa, and then we finished a worship song or two, and then I'm up. And after the service, a woman came up to me, and she says, "Gary, I just got to tell you, I saw you when you walked in." And I didn't know this. I mean, Lisa and I don't practice this. I hope everybody's worshiping. It's the middle of a worship song. But she said, "Just seeing the way that your face lit up when you saw Lisa and the way her face lit up, and I knew you would do anything for her and she adored you." She goes, that was my sermon for me. And it really struck me that we can preach the biggest sermon in front of the pulpit instead of behind it. That people are hungry for that. And that's something you can't fake. And that's what Cherish really points toward. It's, you can't fake your eyes lighting up and the delight you have in each other. And then just last weekend, I was in Oklahoma City. I guess it was 2 weekends ago. And I'd preached on Mary, and this sweet young girl came up, 15, 16 years old. And she goes, "Can I just give you a hug?" "You are a friend." I said, "Okay." And her parents had just told her they're getting a divorce, and her heart was broken. And hearing somebody talk about marriages that can last, that can be a lifelong love, she just needed to hear that. And so I know this is a special group where not only can you impact so many marriages, but it's a special call that you have a certain kind of marriage on your own. That I think that's a joy, and it's an obligation that there's some things you can't fake. And if we settle for a certain kind of marriage, we miss an opportunity, I think, for an outreach that we would enjoy having, that God would want us to have. So let me pray again toward that aim. Lord, I do think of that, Father, how so many here, their marriages are being battered just because of the strategic spiritual warfare going on. And so, Lord, I just pray that you would give them hope and lift them up to a new vision. Lord, I just pray for your physical touch, that I could speak with a clear mind. And I pray that every person here, Lord, would be able to take away something that they could share with others. Father, as we begin to seek to build marriages that honor you, that open up their hearts to you, that speak of you, that proclaim you. In Jesus' name, amen. Wayne Williams grew up as a Chicago Cubs fan because that was his dad's favorite team. So when he was a boy, he and his dad would listen to the games as they would drive in the car. Occasionally they would go to some games live. They would watch them on television. It was a big part of his childhood because his dad was a huge Chicago Cubs fan. Of course, if you follow baseball at all, you know it was a bit of an exercise in futility. They hadn't been back to the World Series since 1906, but at the start of every season, they had their hopes up. And father and son made a solemn pact. When, not if, but when the Cubbies made it back to the World Series, they would listen to the games together. And Wayne couldn't imagine doing anything else. So this last October, when the Cubs finally made it back, Wayne was thinking, you know, it's a bittersweet moment for him. It was sweet because the Cubbies were finally going to be in the World Series. It was a little bit bitter because he lived in North Carolina. But he also believed a promise you made is a promise you keep. So he drove from North Carolina to Indiana. And this is a picture. so he could listen to the games with his dad who had died a couple decades before. He knew his dad wouldn't actually be there, but there was just something about this promise he made that he said, you know what? It wouldn't be right if I'm not listening to games being as near to him as I could. So he drove to where he was buried in Indiana, and not only did he get to hear the Cubs play in the World Series, but he and his dad got to celebrate the Cubs winning the World Series. There's just something moving to me about a guy who says, I made a promise and I want to keep it, particularly when it's not an easy promise to keep. And the reality is most of us made a promise on our wedding day. If we use traditional vows, all of us made this promise, not just to love our wife, but to cherish. I promise to love and to cherish until death do us part. Husbands promise to cherish their wives. Wives promise to cherish their husbands. And it just struck me. I just think it was this gift from God. This word cherish had been hiding in plain sight. I mean, every marriage, but including my own, we focused on love. What does it mean to love? We talked about love. Had every worship or every conference I did on marriage ended with the session on love, because I think it's so key. But I really felt God was saying there's a second part that you promised to do to my daughter, your wife, and that is that you would learn to cherish her. And there's a difference. Love is the substance of a relationship. It'll always be the backbone and the foundation of a marriage. It talks about perseverance and commitment and sacrifice and service. But cherish addresses our heart toward each other, the way we think about each other, the way we talk to and about each other, even that we can cultivate a certain way of feeling about each other. I could look at it this way, that love is the bread. It's the nourishment. It's the substance of a marriage. But cherish is the jam. It's the delight. It's the tasty part. And without love, cherish can't be sustained because it won't have the strength. It will just fade away and die if it doesn't have a backbone of love. But without cherish, love so often becomes duty instead of delight. And that changes the quality of our marriage. It changes the way we look at our spouse and treat our spouse. And it changes our experience in marriage in, I believe, a very negative way. John Wesley, who did not have a marriage that we would want to emulate, in a sermon 20 years after his marriage was over, actually got a great description of what it means to cherish each other in marriage. And so I want to share that with you. He said this. This is our promise to love and to cherish till death do us part. He said, the wife is to have the highest place in the husband's heart, and he in hers. No neighbor, no friend, no parent, no child should be so near and dear to either as the other. They must do more and suffer more for each other than any other in all the world. The husband must do or leave undone anything he can that he may please his wife in diet, attire, choice of company, and all things else. Each must fulfill the other's desire as absolutely as can be done, without transgressing the law of God. Helpful fidelity consists in their mutual care to abstain from and prevent whatever might grieve or hurt either. And I just thought, who doesn't want a marriage like that? I mean, God's view of life is that kids should eventually leave, right? That are above our fidelity to our parents and our friends and our jobs, all of which come and go. There should be this one special person in my life that I get together with, and she will be with me through all seasons, whether it's parenting, whether it's vocation, and that will be a cherishing relationship until the day that one of us dies. And I think if most of us could set up our lives like that, we would want that. But so often we settle for less, I think in part because we've stressed love without stressing cherishing. And what I love about the last half of this, and I just need to say this, that last sentence about it should consist in our desire to abstain from and prevent whatever might grieve or hurt either. I did a blog post a couple months ago that just... It caused some controversy. It's enough is enough. I talked about it. I really believe we need to address the whole problem of domestic violence in the church. That so often we're keeping some women in situations with some cruel men that are using marriage to enact great evil. And I think as a church we should be resisting evil. And the way we're focusing on how to save the marriage or how to save the woman, I don't think we always have been leading them in the right place. But this makes clear, if I'm cherishing my wife, I am so far away from physical abuse, so far away from emotional abuse, so far away from verbal abuse or financial controlling, anything that might grieve or harm her, if I am cherishing her, I'm miles away. And so often we think, as long as we're staying there and loving them, we fulfilled our promise. And I believe that doesn't actually do it. So how do we begin to do this? And the first thing we have to do is to, I don't mean to be awkward. So to cherish my wife is to develop a mindset, attitudes, and actions that make me hold her in high regard. And it's something that I believe we can learn to do. The God who cherishes the imperfect us is more than capable of empowering us and equipping us and inspiring us to cherish an imperfect spouse. So the first step I need to do is to remember, why should I bother to cherish? Because some might say, well, if I'm loving, isn't that enough? I don't know that you can find cherish in the Bible that much. But if I promise my wife that I wouldn't just love her, but cherish her, if you promised your husband that you wouldn't just love him, but cherish him, that was a vow stated before your friends, your in-laws, and before your God, that you were going to develop a certain kind of relationship. Most of us don't think about it past our wedding day. But the fact that we made a vow and don't think about it, I don't believe releases us from that vow. And I think this is where women can kind of have a challenge in marriage as much as men. There's a man I know, he's got a really strong church going, and he was with seven of his male leaders. So these were the guys that had the marriages that most people aspire to have. They would think these are solid marriages, the kind that, you know, people look up to. And he asked all seven of these men, how many of your wives love you? And all seven hands went up. And then he said, how many of your wives like you? And every hand went down. Women, every one of those men felt loved. None of them felt cherished. Does that honor God? And does that honor our vows? In fact, it almost seems ridiculous when we look at the Song of Songs, but this is what we're called to in a cherishing marriage. Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 3. I'm sorry. It's not that one. please don't judge me as a speaker by this. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my beloved among the young men. Now, I don't know that most guys would actually want their wives to say that. It's a little bit too poetic. But to put it in the language of this week, what they would like their wives to say is, like Tom Brady among the athletes, is my husband among the NFL. Daughter-in-law grew up in the Boston area, huge Patriots fan. We've got some very close friends of ours that huge Patriots fan. And the gratitude that that community, that area has for Tom Brady and Bill Belichick is so over the top. There's this joke going around that kind of explains their affection. You know Tom Brady, he seems like he's got this charm life, taking the Patriots to their seventh Super Bowl. No other quarterback has come close to that. Charm life, married to a supermodel named Giselle. But one wife woke up one morning and she's hitting her husband with a pillow. And he wakes up and goes, what is it? She goes, I had a dream last night that you had an affair with Giselle. And her husband said, that's ridiculous. I'd never do that to Tom Brady. So, wives, I think this is where we can challenge the wives. Your husbands know you love them. Do they know you cherish them? And then we also have to challenge the men. Song of Songs 4:9, you have stolen my heart. Wives don't want to know that we're just not going to leave them because the Bible says we can't. But there should be this special way that our eyes light up, where we would be saying to our wives, as the husband says here, you've stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You've stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes. God wants every one of his daughters, every wife to know she can still stop her husband's heart just when he sees her, just when he's around her. And before I wrote Cherish, I tried to practice this. And I remember one morning, it was so powerful to me because I'm very much a morning person. My wife is very much not a morning person. And so I'm usually up a couple hours before. I'm working in my office. And my wife and I are empty nesters now. And I heard her stirring in the bedroom down the hall. And I realized she was up. I heard the footsteps. And my heart leapt like that. Because when you cherish a person and they're literally your favorite person in the world and they're awake. And I knew that in a couple minutes, I'm going to hear her shuffle in with a tired shuffling and hug me while I'm sitting in my chair and say a few words and go out. And when I can honestly say before you and before God, those are some of my favorite moments of every day. There's just a difference in marriage when you cherish the person you're with. And the verse that kept coming up as I was writing cherish, I try not to use a verse too often, but this one just kept coming up because I think this is what every woman wants. Song of Songs, chapter 6, verse 9. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one. The thought that a woman would know, it's not that she's just beyond everybody else, that to her husband, there is nobody else. And what strikes me about this is the whole scourge of pornography. I don't want to get off on this, but that's why it hits women at such a visceral level. Because they feel like they're one of a million to excite their husband's interest when they really want that sense that to their husband, they're the only one, that he is the only one that will ever look at them that way. And that really leads us to the second one. After we remember that we made a promise, we have to look at the mindset. And the mindset that I begin with is going back to the Garden of Eden. What made Adam and Eve have such an intense relationship? And we could say the obvious things. There was no sin, and I'll grant you that. We could say they walked with God in the cool of the day, and sure, that makes sense. Some of the guys might say, duh, they were naked all day long, and fine, okay, I'll give you that. But there's another spiritual principle that we can apply today without walking around naked all day long, and that's this. There was a brief slice of time when Eve was literally the only woman in the world. There was literally no one that Adam could compare her to. She defined what a woman was to him. He couldn't tear her down by saying, well, you know what, she's kind, but I like Janice's laugh better. Or she's not quite as curvy as Shaniqua, or she's not quite as gentle as Sharon, or and all of this. But for her, at that moment, she said, I'm a woman. And Adam said, this is what a woman is. And we can get to that point. I call it a commitment to contentment. When we make that marital choice, our spouse starts to define to us what a woman is supposed to be and what a man is supposed to be, and we don't fault them for what they're not. And when we don't fault somebody for what they're not, it's amazing how much we begin to cherish them, because it's what we're not that often undercuts the whole process of cherishing. So I've got to look at my wife as Eve, the only woman in the world. Women have to look at their husband as Adam, the only man in the world. Now, some might say, is that realistic? I'd say, not only is it realistic, it's happened for just about every man I know that's married. As a pastor, like many of you, I've stood up there as people are getting married. I've stood next to high-powered businessmen and whatnot that want to have a straight face because their business associates and friends are watching. But when that bride is coming up the aisle, and I've noticed this recently, maybe you have too, it used to be as soon as those doors opened up and the bridal march plays, every head turns to look at the bride. And I don't know if there's just been some internet memes or something, but I'm noticing more and more people that are sneaking a glance at the groom. You know, is he smiling? Does he look afraid? Does he look happy? What's the expression on his face? And as that bride is walking up the aisle, I'll look at this guy that I spent a lot of time with preparing for marriage, and I can tell you, she is the only woman in the world. Everybody else is background furniture. Everybody else is black and white. She's in color. He's transfixed. And what I'm trying to suggest is, what if it's possible that doesn't have to be a once-in-a-life opportunity? What if it's possible that every morning when your spouse wakes up, when you have a heart to cherish them, you look at them at that moment, you just can't wait to talk to them. They're the only person in the world. Because I believe if God can make that happen once, I believe you can make it a regular reality of our life. And the reality is, people expect us to treat each other that way. So why don't we treat each other that way? Huh? Others expect you, particularly when you're in the ministry, when you're in leadership, they expect you to treat your spouse that way. My wife and I were at a sacred marriage conference, And it was, you know, the busy thing is it's just about to launch on a Friday night. Lisa's setting up the book table. I'm off in the green room kind of pulling up my notes, making sure we've got everything set. And they said, Gary, we need to do a mic check. It was on the other side of the church past the book table. So I'm running out to do the mic check while Lisa's setting up the books. And it was kind of rushed. I didn't have time to stop and say hi. But I wanted to acknowledge her. So just as I'm walking by, I just kind of pat her on the rear end, which she likes. It's not demeaning to her. She likes me to acknowledge that. And so I'm just kind of patting her. I go by. But there was this woman that was sitting across, and she saw it, and Lisa said she got the nastiest look on her face. I mean, she was so angry, and she marches up to my wife. She goes, is that Gary Thomas? Lisa goes, yeah, actually, it is. And then she's got even angrier, and she goes, are you his wife? And there's just something about her attitude that just really bothered my wife, and so she said, no, his wife was with him last weekend. This weekend, it's my turn. And I go, Lisa, you can't say that. And she goes, Gary, you're such a good man. You would never do it. It made me so angry that she thinks you could do that. I go, honey, she doesn't know me from anyone. And she did get it right. She told you. And, you know, Roger's met my wife. She's freakishly young. Right? She's done book tables before. One person came up to her, not making this up, said, you must be so proud of your daddy. And she said, I am, but he had nothing to do with these books. So she's a perfect eater. I've lost my hair. So it was easy for that woman to mistake what was going on there. But the reality is others see, you know, we're supposed to have this thing. Well, can we just have the same expectations for ourselves that others have of us, especially when we're in leadership? And what I love about this mindset, the Adam and Eve mindset, is it undercuts the two areas that makes most spouses feel by gender. I hate to do stereotypes, but it tends to be true by gender where they're most frustrated. When I think of women, women tend to be expert infidelity detectors. They just know when their husband's affections aren't set on him, when his mind is wandering. And they'll often accuse the husband. The husband will adamantly deny it until there's incontrovertible proof and you figure out the wife's suspicions were right. And when I'm looking at my wife as Eve, the only one in the world, it's meeting that base need that gives her a sense of security and contentment and value, that she fills up my eyes, that she stops my heart still. Even after 30 years of marriage. And for men, just as women tend to be expert infidelity detectors, men, we are so sensitive at being disappointment detectors. And when our wives can just kind of give that sigh or that eye roll, we know our wives aren't going to leave us. We know our wives aren't going to go cheat. But boy, they sure don't cherish us. They're pretty disappointed in us. And so when a wife cultivates that attitude toward her husband, I believe she starts to create the foundation out of which the marriage can really take off. Because men want to know their wives aren't just disappointed in them, that they cherish them. Women want to know that we don't just attract to them and value them for their gifts and their person, but that we cherish them. And when you think about it, there was a time in our relationship, think about this, when everybody knew we were crazy about the person we married. They saw us, they heard us talking about them. They saw us talking together. They saw the way our eyes lit up when we were together, how we wanted to touch each other. There was a time when that was happening. Did we change or did our spouse change? Or did we just decide in our marriage, as long as we stay together and love each other, we don't have to keep cherishing each other? And I think cherish is a new call to go to a different place. The third thing, though, so we have the remember our promise. That's what it's based on. Secondly, we have that mindset of the Garden of Eden. And third, we have a practice called showcasing. To cherish your spouse is to showcase your spouse. What I mean by this is that when you cherish something, what do you want to do? You want to show it off. When a guy cherishes his car, He takes pictures around. He asks people to come out and see it. He gets new wheels. It's not really done until 5 or 6 people do it, or they'll post it on Facebook or something. You just want to show it off. It's like a woman when she gets engaged, she's going to show that ring to everybody. I can't remember the last time my wife asked anybody to see a ring, partly because I was a very poor seminary student when we got married. But But, you know, when it first happened, everybody says, oh, show me that ring. Well, that's what happens when you begin to cherish someone. You want to showcase them. And here's the thing. Showcasing is a good way to cherish your spouse, but it makes you cherish your spouse more. The way I use, the analogy I use to explain the practice of showcasing is ballet. George Balanchine is a Russian-born choreographer, probably one of the most famous ballet choreographers in the world. He had this phrase where he said, the ballet is woman. And what he meant by that is that when you go to see a ballet, people want to see the ballerina. It's her grace, her athleticism, her strength, her beauty that is showcased. And so the best male dancers, at least in what they call pas de deux, couples dancing, the best male dancers understand that their job is just to support the ballerina. Now, they can't be blind. They have to know her weaknesses because they have to support them and cover them up. But he also has to know her strengths so that he can show those strengths and exploit those strengths so that everybody can see that. And because he's behind her, catching her and lifting her and turning her, she can do more with him than she could on her own. She can look like a more brilliant dancer because he's taking care of her weaknesses and extending her strengths. George also said that his job was to make the beautiful yet more beautiful. And I just love that approach where he says every dancer has a certain beauty, but how do I bring out even more beauty? And so when we cherish our spouse, that's what we're trying to do. Sarah Jessica Parker had a video that she made of couples dancing. Well, it's a series of videos on the New York Ballet Company. And this is one where they talk a little bit about partner dancing.
When a male dancer is paired with a ballerina, he can support, stabilize, lift, and turn her, allowing the partner to perform feats she could never do alone.
One of my favorite parts of dancing is partnering. I love having a connection with someone on stage.
There's a saying we have that ballet is woman. The best thing I can do as a partner is to kind of disappear and make sure that everybody in the audience is enjoying her performance.
Because it's not about you. It's about making the woman look beautiful.
It takes true artistry to make a woman feel that safe on stage while she's trying to do all these different things. You just have to have that trust.
It's not always perfect or safe, but usually they'll catch you before your head hits the ground.
Usually.
Well, I got dropped on my head once.
Partnering's a lot about confidence, and you have to go for things, because if you don't go for it, then it doesn't work out.
Right.
Yeah. And a lot of these lifts I've never done before, and they're kind of scary. I'm sort of afraid of heights. With Craig, I'm not afraid at all. Well, I know he's not going to drop me, right?
Yeah, not yet.
He could be a little more confident there, right, if he wants to assure. How do you think marriages would change? Just think of the marriages that you're working with. Instead of coming to you with all of the things that they're disappointed about and what their spouse doesn't, and the focus of the conversation is, how do I support my spouse where they're weak and exploit their strengths so that the beautiful becomes yet more beautiful? That to cherish someone, we're sort of like polishing that diamond on the ring, washing off the gold, that we're really trying to show our spouse's best side. There's a couple that did that a couple years ago. Dr. Hugh Ross visited Houston, Texas. He's a Canadian-American astrophysicist. And he held 5,000 people spellbound as he made it seem ridiculous based on science alone to not believe in God. I mean, it was amazing the presentation he gives. He has a website called reasons.org. I love it. One half is if you believe, go to this side. If you don't believe, go to that side. It was a compelling presentation. Then in the question and answer session, so spontaneous questions, right? He didn't have notes. He's pulling out theorems and facts. This just made you feel like you're speaking with a different species of brain. But in the midst of his talk, just kind of as an aside, he mentioned that he has Asperger's. I thought, how does that work? And so I went to his wife while people were signing the books, and I went up and I said, just tell me about how this started. And she told me the story of, as a young woman, she had prayed so often to God, "Lord, I just want to serve you. I want my life to be to help others connect with you." And while she was in college, she met this brilliant young Caltech postdoctoral student who was volunteering at a church. She saw the great presentations, but she also noticed the social awkwardness that was kind of holding it back a little bit. So she made some friendly suggestions, and Hugh figured out that she was a friend, that she was doing it with a good heart. And so he just sat her down one time very directly and said, "All right, tell me what I need to do." And she said, basically, "Okay, Hugh, let's start with the haircut. All right, just go to somebody and ask him to make it look normal. All right, don't tell him how to cut it. Just say, make it look normal." And she goes, "And the clothes. Stripes don't go with plaids. Your pants should cover your socks. Your socks should match. Why don't you just go to Macy's and just tell her to dress you? All right, get a couple outfits and she'll just set you up." And when you give these great principles, give us an application so that we could hold on to it. And she said, "And Hugh, this is really important. When you're talking to someone, look them in the eye. It makes a huge difference." Hugh literally got out a 3x5 card and wrote it down: haircut, clothes, application, look people in the eye. And his ministry started to take off to an even deeper level. And he realized he was having a greater impact. And so he got together with Kathy, and here was his romantic invitation: "Kathy, with my postdoctoral studies and volunteering at the church, I only have one day off a week. But would you like to spend that one day getting to know each other a little better?" Well, she was delighted, and they fell in love, and they got married, and they've had this huge ministry because Kathy realized, "I think I can reach more people for the Lord by supporting Hugh and knowing his weaknesses but showcasing his strengths, so that together we can reach more people than I could have on my own or Hugh could have on his own." And I explained the Ballet Is Woman video, and her eyes just lit up because that's the story of her life. That's what she does in showcasing her husband. And here's the reason their marriage works so well. Hugh doesn't expect Kathy to have the brain of an astrophysicist. He doesn't expect her to do that. And Kathy doesn't expect Hugh not to exhibit signs of Asperger's. She knew what she was getting into. But they support each other's weaknesses. They polish off each other's strengths. And they have this incredible impact and satisfaction with each other because they've learned what it means to showcase, where the beautiful has become yet more beautiful. Now, let me stop for a second here. I'm talking about this between husband and wife and wife and husband, but there's a deeper element. Imagine you're a parent and you've got a son with Asperger's and you've got normal hopes for him as any parent would. And here this woman comes along and loves your boy, knowing all of the challenges, and helps him and encourages him and cherishes him so he doesn't just get by, but he has a huge impact for God's kingdom. What would you think about that woman who married your son? Women, what do you think God thinks about you when you marry a man who has weaknesses, who has challenges, and you say, "I know those challenges, but I can build up on those weaknesses. I can showcase his strengths, and he can have a more powerful ministry with me by his side than he could have without." This is an act of worship as much as it's an act of relationship. And of course, there are occasions when men can showcase their wives. I think of Laura and Kurt, friends of ours back in Houston, Texas. Laura was born in Texas, moved out to Louisiana, then spent the rest of her life in Texas. So she is the epitome of a Southern girl. Large and in charge personality, slight frame, big personality, popular Bible study teacher. I mean, just a great teacher, great friend, sort of commands the room, that kind of charismatic presence. And it wasn't until we had known her a while that I realized how messed up her childhood had been. And it started in kindergarten. She had a ritual every day. When she came home from kindergarten, she'd go down for a nap, wake up, put on her fancy dress and her stiff white shoes, and she'd wait out on the curb about a block away where she lived. This was over 50, 60 years ago, and it's safer to do this. And her dad would stop, pick her up, give her a kiss, put her in the car, drive her to the apartment where they lived. One afternoon in the spring, she did what she'd done all year, got up from her nap, put on the dress and shoes. She's waiting on the curb, and her dad never shows up. Her mom finally comes out and says, "Laura, honey, I think you better just come in." And Laura's like, "No, I can't. I don't want my dad to think I'm not waiting for him. I got dressed for him. He's got to come home." And her mom came out another half hour later and said, "Laura, honey, you just got to come in." And Laura couldn't believe it. And she held vigil at the plate glass window, knowing that somehow her daddy would come home, and she didn't get it. I'm dressed up. I don't know why he'd do it. Why wouldn't he come home? And that vigil at the plate glass window lasted for decades. She would only see her dad two other times the rest of her life. And one of those times was just 2 weeks before he died. And growing up her entire time in her childhood, she just wondered, why didn't he come home? I was all dressed. I'm left waiting there. She just wanted to know why he didn't. As an adult now, she knows there isn't a good answer. But when you're a little girl, you're just looking for it, and it shapes who you are. So when she met Kurt and they were going to get married, she was very clear with Kurt. Kurt, I don't care how much money you make. I don't care what kind of car we drive. I don't care how big our house is. I just want to be cherished. And one of the first things Kurt learned, and good for him, was that to cherish Laura means coming home on time. He married a real woman with a real past and real hurts. And that's cost him vocationally, because when it's 5:30, he's got to pack up and the boss wants him to get something done, or there are other tasks that others, Kurt would pass by, because he knew what it meant to Laura. And Laura told me now, 40 years into their marriage, I mean, misting up as she's telling me, Gary, the best part of every day is at 6 p.m. when I hear that garage door kick on, and I know my man is coming home to me. And you see that from a little girl who was left standing on the curb, and Kurt decided as a husband, his wife is never going to be left standing waiting for him. She's going to know. He's going to cherish her above his job, above his ego, above his promotional advancement. He's going to cherish his wife just by getting home. And then he supports her in her Bible studies. He gives her time to study. He lets her go on those mission trips. And he's learned to indulge his wife. One time he found out, you know, they didn't have a lot of money. And so he would get these preseason tickets to the ballet that they would give to some companies, like $5 a ticket when they're just trying to refine it. And he saw how much Laura loved it, because when she was a girl, she didn't get any of that. And so one Christmas he splurged and spent more money than he should have. And he got her season tickets to the ballet. And Laura gushes that he even got great seats. And what it meant to Laura, because she could never do that as a young girl. And Kurt wanted to say, you're worth spending time on. You're worth indulging. Here's what Laura has said. I'm such a strong person, but the fact that Kurt lets me be me makes me feel especially cherished. I'm the upfront person, the outgoing one. Some men might say, hey, why should she be front and center all the time? But Kurt cherishes me for who I am. He lets me soar in those settings rather than fighting against me. For a man to let his wife be the shining one, that's special. And it encourages me to be the highest version of myself. And that last line really captures it. That's the ballet as woman analogy. She becomes the highest version of herself because her husband has said, I can't take away your childhood, but every day I could chip at it. You're not going to be left at the curb anymore. And you're going to get some of those indulgences you never got as a little girl. And I'm going to support you and release you to be who God created you to be. And now she is. And as she is celebrated by others, that makes Kurt cherish her even more, which builds her up more so that she's celebrated more, which helps him to increase his cherishing. And that's what I love about cherishing. The more I cherish my spouse, the more I cherish my spouse. It builds on itself. Because I act in a certain way that cherishes her, that creates the feelings. I show her off to others, and when I see others celebrate my wife, then I celebrate her even more, which makes me more eager to act that way, and cherishing grows. Now, everything the world values does the opposite. Infatuation, 12 to 18 month shelf life. We all know that. Youth and vitality and beauty, we get less strong, right? We get less healthy. All of those things, sexual chemistry tends to fade. All the things that makes people go into marriage that fade so quickly. What I love about cherishing is that it builds and it grows and it can be chosen. You don't get to choose to fall in love, and you can't choose not falling out of love. Those are the romantic things that just come and go. You can choose to cherish. You can grow cherished. I believe this is a strategy and a pathway that we can teach, that we can help couples recapture that. And it's not just in the big things like we saw with Kathy showcasing Hugh or with Kurt showcasing Laura. We practice it in the little things. I think for me with Lisa one time, we had this couple we knew that just gotten married for their first year anniversary. I thought up a gift, mentioned it. Lisa goes, oh, that's a brilliant idea. That's a great idea. We got to do that. She said, I'm going to take care of it. I said, great. So I checked a week later. Have we got it? She goes, no, I forgot. Thanks for reminding me. We got to get it done. So she got it. She sent it off. First time we saw the couple, the wife just started gushing to my wife. It's so touching. I was so moved. I'm so grateful. Thank you so much. And while she's gushing to my wife, I walk in the room and she sees me out of the corner of her eye. She sees that I hear a little bit over here, a little bit what she's saying. So she throws out the, oh, and thank you too, Gary. You know, it's one of those thank you too, like, Gary, you and I both know you had absolutely nothing to do with that gift. The only contribution you made is you married this incredibly thoughtful and generous and kind woman, but you did marry her, so thank you too. 15 years ago, to my shame, I probably would have said, what are you talking about? That gift was my idea, and I paid for it, and I had to follow up with it. You wouldn't have that gift if it wasn't for me, right? But why now would I say, as I did, what present? And then why would my wife immediately say, oh, don't be silly, Gary, you know that gift was your idea. Why am I trying to showcase my wife and my wife is trying to showcase me? We've just found marriage is a whole lot happier when we showcase each other. I love people being enthralled by my wife. I want people to see that my wife's excellent. I want her to celebrate. I want to be that male dancer who twists and turns and catches her and throws her so at the end she lands in the spotlight. The crowd erupts into a thunder standing ovation. And I just step back into the shadows and watch. My job is done. The ballerina is showcased. Because you know what? It's just very satisfying to cherish the person you're married to. Just think about the wisdom of that. If you can cherish the person that you wake up with every day, that you go home to every day, it just makes for a much happier marriage. It makes for a much happier life. And again, it's things that we can practice. I have a whole chapter on different practices, but one that really helped me that I did last year, I stole this from another wife. I got a stationery journal. It had daily entries. And every day of the year in 2016, I just wrote down something Lisa did that day that I wanted to thank her for. Or something that I just appreciated her for. And I kept it secret. She didn't know I was doing it every day. But literally, think about this. Every day, the first thing I did every day, before I had my devotions, before I started working, I opened up that little red book. All right, God, what am I thanking Lisa for that she did yesterday? What am I celebrating about her? And, it, you know, the first couple months, you're just clicking things off. But I can't keep saying the same thing. So long about September and October, as excellent as my wife is, I'm still having to pray. I'm like, God, you got to open up my mind. I want to cherish Lisa. I want to thank her. Help me. And every time God answered that. And what was so curious to me, in 2016, I counted, I only asked God to change Lisa one time. And the reason is, when you've got a book with literally hundreds of things about your spouse that you've celebrated, it just seems a little bit picky to ask him to change one more thing. It's like somebody gives you a new Mercedes-Benz and you're hacked off because the diesel tank only holds 24 gallons instead of 18, right? And you start to say, do you not realize the incredible gift that you have? And I remember traveling with that journal in the middle of last summer because you have 150 entries in at the time. And I think, man, what if I lose this thing? It's irreplaceable. I can't remember all that. But you know what? It still would have been a gift because it changed the way I treated my wife. It changed the way I talked to her and about her. And she didn't know, but that was a gift that was reaching her every day. And by waking up every day thinking those thoughts, it did give me a cherishing heart. And so I just gave you point four without mentioning that it was point four. So that's what it is. So what we have to do is we cherish because we know it's a promise. We get the mindset of Adam and Eve. We showcase our spouse. And then we practice little things like I mentioned with this journal. And here's the hope. Here's what I want people to get. I was in Winnipeg last February. They call it Winterpeg. And they should, because it's about 6 months of frigid weather. And this guy gave me a ride back to my hotel. It was snowy and icy, so he had to take his time. And he was older, and he liked to take his time driving. But I was glad he did, because he told me this fascinating story. He'd had two wives. His first marriage had lasted 21 years, and his wife died of ovarian cancer. And it's one of those awful scenarios where the last 8 months, he's doing everything. He's cleaning, he's cooking, he's preparing, he's shopping, he's there. I mean, when your wife is that sick, That's all you do. And he admits that his first marriage was pretty traditional. He loved her. He provided for her, but he didn't really serve her extravagantly or anything. He just thought, you know, I show up, I pay the bill, and I'm, you know, just kind of that traditional kind of marriage. Well, she died, and then he was single for 4 years, and as a single man, he had to do everything on his own. So when he got married to his second wife, Sharon, he just kept doing what he had done for the last 8 months of his first marriage and what he had done as a single. He was serving her. He was cherishing her. He would call her princess. And his motto was, what would you do for a princess? That's what I'm going to do for Sharon. It was Sharon's first marriage. She thought she had died and gone to heaven. She had heard all these wives that talked about the expectations of husbands and the demands and how life can get so difficult. And here she couldn't believe the way that she was cherished. And Terry told me, Gary, my second marriage was so much better than my first. It was richer. It was more fulfilling. It was happier. He goes, not because my second wife is better than my first wife. She wasn't. As far as their relational ability and their character and their godliness, they were about the same. But my attitude was so different. I loved my first wife. I cherished my second wife. And it made me so much happier. And most of the people that you work with or preach to or counsel think their marriage would be better if they were married to someone else. And Terry's tale of two wives teaches us their marriage would be better if they would change their attitude. If they would apply cherishing, they could be married to essentially the same person and their level of satisfaction can go through the roof if they say, I promise not just to love, but to cherish. And the reason I think this is an important message is it makes me really sad and kind of angry sometimes if I don't get a hold of it, that young people who are infatuated think they have something better than us people who have been married for a long time. Because that's what our culture celebrates. Our culture is infatuated with infatuation. But you know what? I think cherishing is better. I've been infatuated. And infatuation, I mean, I just think of this couple that was going into a second marriage that Lisa and I were getting together with, hoping that they could have a good start. But they were clearly so infatuated. You know, it's the kind of couple that are kind of having sex with their hands over it. And you're saying, guys, just put it under the table, okay? I'm trying to eat. But you know the way they do that? You know. And I realized I honestly didn't envy them. Because I said, you know, it's going to be a great 12 to 18 months and the infatuation dies and they're going to have to figure out who they really married and they're going to have to learn the process of building relational intimacy and then do I learn to cherish this person? And I was so glad, frankly, I'm so glad to be on the other side. Because infatuation is marked by desperation. It's marked by insecurity. It comes so strongly, but you can't control it. You can't control whether it goes. So there's all of that that's going on. Cherish is something you can choose and you can build, and it's based on something that's real. And I'm just so glad. I've been infatuated and I've been in a cherishing marriage, and I think cherishing marriages are much better. And I even believe they can make young people envious instead of look down on us. And I know that sounds like hyperbole, but let me tell you an example where that actually happened. Lisa and I have a friend named Dr. Greg Bledsoe. He is the Surgeon General of Arkansas. I didn't know Arkansas had a Surgeon General until he was appointed Surgeon General, but he is. And when he was still a young medical student, he was doing rounds with the resident physician. They walk into a room with a couple in their 80s, and the wife had a neuromuscular disease, so she's sitting in a wheelchair. Her head is off the side. She couldn't speak. She would just sit there and moan, and her head was off in an angle, and she couldn't keep her mouth shut, and so little drool would come out. And Greg was just struck. The husband, he looks so young for somebody in his 80s and spry and full of energy. Because he said, usually it's the other way around. You know, the wife is pushing in a husband who's in that state. But this time it was reversed. And the husband would just lovingly wipe the jewel off his wife's cheek. And just things were going on. And Greg saw this man and he thought, you know, in his 80s, this guy's dealing with this. And he said, I have to admit, I felt sorry for him. I mean, at this age, this period of your life, who wants to have to do that? And then he looked at the wife's chart. He saw what her address was. He flipped over. He saw the husband's chart. Same address. And he realized he didn't pick her up at a nursing home and drive her to the hospital. He was this woman's primary caregiver. And he found himself saying, as a young man often would, "Please, God, not me ever. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I'm not signing up for that." He felt so sorry for the man. Well, the resident physician got a page. Had pagers back then. So he leaves the room, and Greg wasn't far enough along in his studies to do anything medically helpful for the couple. So he just kind of stood there, and it was awkward. And the husband saw the awkwardness, but the husband also saw Greg's expression. And he realized that Greg didn't get how wonderful this woman is. He realized that Greg was seeing this woman in her 80s, a neuromuscular disease, moaning and drooling. And so he just spoke up with this really spunky voice. And he said, "She's my fishing buddy, you know." Greg said, "What?" "And she's my fishing buddy. We've been fishing all over 50 years. You've never seen a fisher like her. In fact, there's this lake down there. We set up these trot lines. She would beat everybody." And he's just transfixed. He said, "You see a woman who's broken down." He goes, "I see the joy of my heart. This is a woman that I cherish." And Greg went on. This was so amazing where he said this. "For the next 10 minutes, I was transfixed as this man, who moments before I had pitied, regaled me with story after story of his life together with his wife. It was incredible. What was even more incredible, however, was the change that occurred in me. Watching this elderly man caress his wife's hand, kiss her cheek, wipe away her drool, and joyfully recount their lives together provoked a powerful transformation of perspective within me. Gone was any semblance of pity. Instead, in its place, was envy." Greg saw this man cherishing his wife and envied what he had, because he realized when that man was wiping the drool off her cheek, he was back to being a 22-year-old guy on a date whose girlfriend got a little bit of ice cream and in a flirty way, "Let me take that off." It was no different to him. A Victoria's Secret model with a quantum physics master's could have walked by that room and he wouldn't have turned his eye for a second, because she was his dove, his perfect one, the only one. And he wanted Greg to see. He wanted to showcase his wife. "You should see the woman I'm married to. Don't look at her now. This is who she is." Now notice, Greg didn't envy the man when the man was loving his wife. He felt sorry for the man when the man was loving his wife. Greg envied the man when he saw the man cherish his wife. That's the difference. That's the kind of marriages I want to see us build. That's the kind of marriages I want us to experience, because those are the kind of marriages I believe God created us to experience. All right, I was told we could have some time for question and answers.